The Tom Woods Show, episode 2247.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you old timers out there from the Ron Paul 2008 campaign, you may remember my friend Larry Lepard, who spent $200,000 of his own money on full-page newspaper ads in support of Dr. Paul. Well, Larry has had an uncanny way with money over the years, and he made a presentation to my paid membership on how to insure yourself against currency debasement. That is to say, how to survive inflation. Well, I took that presentation out from behind the paywall, and I'm making it available to the general public for free. Check it out at tomwoods.com/Larry. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm delighted to welcome Whitney Webb back to the program. She is an investigative journalist. You may well have heard of. If you follow me, it's not at all unlikely that you would follow her also. And of course, she wants to caution us. We hear the word journalist today, what makes our skin crawl. But there actually are real live people doing really good and noble and important things under that title. And we're going to be talking today about her two volumes not too long ago released called One Nation Under Blackmail, The Sordid Union Between Intelligence and Organized Crime That Gave Rise to Jeffrey Epstein. So, Whitney, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You've been pretty busy since the last time you were on the Tom Woods Show.
I can't
get over this project.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I think the last time I was on was a few years ago, and I agreed to write the book not that long after I came out and had what was my original four-part series on the Epstein case for Mint Press News, which came out in the latter part of 2019. And then in early 2020, January, actually, I signed the contract to do the book. And then, of course, 2 months later, the world went totally insane. So the book took a little longer than originally anticipated because of that, because I don't think a lot of us back in January 2020 really foresaw the extent of changes to our lives that would be foisted upon us. So it was actually a much more ambitious project than I thought, mainly because I wanted to be as thorough and detailed as possible. Because when you're dealing with something like this, if you're the mainstream media, any sort of discussion of Jeffrey Epstein and intelligence ties, it gets smeared as conspiracy theory, despite the fact that a sitting Secretary of Labor said that he had been told when he was a U.S. attorney to go light on Epstein because Epstein belonged to intelligence and was above his pay grade. So obviously there's something there, but we're told Epstein killed himself. Epstein didn't have intelligence ties. He was just a naughty billionaire. And now that he's dead, everything's fine. So the more I ended up looking into the nature of those intelligence connections, it obviously became clear that the book was going to be a bit longer than originally intended. And also because the nature of those intelligence connections, in order to really understand them, you have to have a pretty decent understanding of certain events, particularly in the 1980s, things like Iran-Contra, the Promise software scandal, things of that nature. And in my experience, most Americans have no idea what that stuff is, or at least in the case of Iran-Contra, they think of it more as the arms for hostages scandal and all of this. But really, it was bigger than that, as people in your audience are probably aware, at least to an extent. But anyway, I felt the need to sort of add a lot of context about those events in order to understand Epstein, but also the fact that sexual blackmail has been utilized by a particular network that is born out of the symbiosis between organized crime and intelligence during World War II and the post-World War II era. And Epstein is quite clearly part of this broader network, which is decentralized. Not necessarily they view themselves as a network, maybe factions of them do, but there's definitely a lot of continuity between those groups back in the 40s and the networks that Jeffrey Epstein worked within.
Let me pause with a cautionary note that I assume is obvious, but I pride myself on putting out a family-friendly podcast, not in the sense that a fourth grader is going to want to listen, but that if they are in the car and they do listen, they're not going to learn any new vocabulary from the Tom Woods Show. But
right.
I don't know exactly where this conversation will go. If you're a parent driving in the car, use your judgment about this particular subject matter. So volume one, exactly what you're talking about, takes us into the period before Epstein, indeed to give us some context to show that Epstein is not some oddball, unusual character, but that rather that he fits into a kind of macabre tradition, I suppose we might say. And then in volume two, then we introduce Jeffrey Epstein. So I suppose we should start with volume one. Now, there's an enormous amount of material in here, and it traces out connections between people and institutions in ways that I think my audience will appreciate, because it's very much in the tradition of how Murray Rothbard used to write his books. And you start off, I think, in the 1940s,
yeah,
suggesting that this actually goes back much farther than most Americans would think.
Yeah. So the book starts off talking about something called Operation Underworld, which the U.S. government reluctantly had to admit did take place roughly 60 years after the fact. But Operation Underworld was when the Office of Naval Intelligence and the precursor to the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, teamed up formally with organized crime. And part of this was done in order to ensure access of the ONI and the OSS to intelligence being gathered by dock workers. They wanted to work with the dock workers union in New York City Harbor. That union was controlled by the mob. And it wasn't the only union controlled by the mob at this point. They controlled most unions in New York City. And this is how they got sort of a foothold in the door of the New York Democratic Party. And basically by this point that Operation Underworld takes happen in the 40s had essentially taken over the New York Democratic Party. That's why, for example, the Democratic mayor of New York, when Operation Underworld takes place, William O'Dwyer, was very deeply and provably affiliated with organized crime, including gangsters like Frank Costello when he was in office. And actually, Harry Truman shielded him from prosecution by appointing him to be ambassador of Mexico so he could get immunity. But his chief of staff, I believe, was prosecuted and convicted for corruption and organized crime connections. But basically, I'm trying to paint a picture of how these particular interests started to formally mingle together. You can argue and make a convincing case that they informally mingled prior to Operation Underworld. But in Operation Underworld, we have documentation that this intermingling began, and it sort of set off a symbiosis that later led to essentially a fusion of intelligence and organized crime.
This seems to people who, to use this overused metaphor, people who were blue-pilled, this seems impossible to believe, because this isn't the U.S. government they learned about in their sixth grade history class or high school civics. They don't learn about this. They learn about how a bill becomes a law and that the president is just trying to do what he can to advance the general welfare. And then you look at this underworld that you're describing, and it just seems inconceivable to most people.
Yeah, so when you say something like that, what came to my mind was this, I guess, sort of infamous comment of Hillary Clinton's, where she said something, she was giving a speech to a bank on Wall Street, I forget which bank, but said something like, you have to have a public and a private position, right? So the public gets one story from you, and privately, you're telling another story. And that sort of division is true for how power functions in the United States. We are publicly fed a narrative about how power works in the United States, but in reality, privately, other factors, other factions, other groups are really running the show. And so I think it's more obvious now, perhaps, with Joe Biden ostensibly at the helm of the U.S. government. I think there's a significant portion of Americans that don't really see him as the main decision maker of U.S. policy today. But you could argue this has been going on for a long time, that really, you know, the president being seen as the ostensible boss of the country is increasingly beholden to other interests. And this is, for anyone that's familiar with the Kennedy assassination, it's very likely that these particular interests, particularly of intelligence and organized crime coming together, you have both in the Kennedy assassination. So after that type of event, if you're president and you want to challenge those interests and you have that president of Kennedy in front of you, it gets complicated, I guess, to say the very least.
Well, given that your book is called One Nation Under Blackmail, let's talk specifically about what this consists of. Who is being blackmailed and how? Now, obviously, you have a huge, huge story here, but just speak in general terms. What is the idea behind doing this? Is it to make certain people in society, particularly politicians, do the bidding of those who kind of really run the country? What's it all about fundamentally?
So, in talking about this team up between organized crime and intelligence, blackmail is something that was, particularly sex blackmail, was something that was really perfected by organized crime and obviously becomes a tactic adopted by intelligence. If you think of what blackmail is, it's using information as leverage over another person. And to the intelligence community, such information is deemed intelligence. And if you're familiar with how intelligence agencies work, there's nothing they won't do, no act they won't justify if the end goal of it was to obtain quote unquote intelligence, whatever that means. So in understanding that situation, it becomes pretty clear how these two groups, organized crime and intelligence, develop this sort of symbiotic relationship. But it's not just sex blackmail. You have many different types of blackmail here. And I discuss several of them in the book. For example, in the context of BCCI, there were people that wanted to take over a particular bank in the US that was later used to help BCCI enter the US financial system. They wanted to obtain that bank because many congressmen banked with that bank, and then they would have had access to the financial activities of congressmen and could have used that for financial blackmail. And the person who wanted that was a man named Armin Hammer, who some people in your audience may be familiar with, the longtime head of Occidental Petroleum, but his father was a spy for the Soviet Union, and Armin Hammer was dogged with allegations for years that he also had affiliations with Soviet era intelligence. And that's the financial blackmail level. There's also sexual blackmail, of course, which comes up again and again, even in volume one, before we get to Epstein, of different examples of sexual blackmail operations being used by people either tied to intelligence or being tied to organized crime, or sometimes both. And ultimately, what you're doing there is its aim is to control people with the threat that you will release damaging information if they don't comply with what you would like them to do. So in the case of organized crime, you could say that perhaps they would like politicians or law enforcement to not prosecute them for their crimes and offer essentially state protection for their rackets. If you're an intelligence agency, you don't want Congress to investigate you. You don't want law enforcement to investigate you, and you want Congress to give you more money, a bigger budget, and more power progressively over time. So obviously they have competing agendas. And if you consider the fact that major factions of our intelligence agencies have been teamed up with organized crime for a long time, you can sort of see how we ended up getting to the point where we are today. The subversion and corruption of our institutions has been going on for a very long time. And unfortunately, it's just not very well known. But as I point out in the book, I document this pretty exhaustively. There have been blips on the radar of this scandal and that scandal over the course of decades. And when you string it all together, it becomes very clear that this has been going on a long time. It's never stopped, and there's never been accountability. So why would they discontinue these practices when they've been hugely successful for them?
Can you explain how the interesting figure of Roy Cohn fits into this story?
Yeah, so Roy Cohn is a really interesting figure, and I use him as a vehicle for exploring a lot of things in the book. So for example, I talk about his parents in great detail because I think it shows a lot about how power worked, particularly in this area of New York City, which of course is a particular area that's also very important to the Epstein story and understanding it, since he was so active there as well. But Roy Cohn, he was a lawyer, and very early on in his legal career was essentially propelled to heights that would normally be closed off to someone of his inexperience, I guess. So for example, I think at age 23, roughly, he was chief counsel to McCarthy as part of the McCarthy hearings in the 50s. And actually those hearings to a large extent fell apart when Roy Cohn was attempting to blackmail the army to prevent his friend who was associated with the committee, David Shine, from being sent overseas to fight in, I guess it would be the Korean War or something like that. So in attempting to blackmail the army, this spurred the Army McCarthy hearings, which led to the downfall of both McCarthy and Cohn. And then, of course, after that point, Cohn doesn't just disappear off the map. He goes back to legal practice in New York City and becomes a major lawyer for organized crime interests, but also other people, including Donald Trump, for example, probably his most well-known legal client. And Donald Trump is on record calling Roy Cohn his mentor. But in the same period of time we're talking about, Roy Cohn, including when he was involved in the McCarthy hearings, was either entrapped by or, well, he was definitely involved in, but his involvement was allegedly due to his initial entrapment in a sexual blackmail operation that involved people, including FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and a businessman named Louis Rosenstiel. Louis Rosenstiel was an organized crime-linked liquor baron who earlier on in his career was tied to people like the Bronfmans, and then later on had a rather acrimonious split with the Bronfmans. But a lot of the organized crime connections that both the Bronfmans and Rosenstiel had during Prohibition and the bootlegging era continued well after prohibition ended as a policy. And I feel like I did a pretty good job in the book of documenting those connections and the different aspects of this particular sexual blackmail operation that was involved there. And allegedly some of the pictures that were taken at these particular sexual blackmail soirees, these ended up in the hands of big time mafia and mob guys like Mayor Lansky. And some of those photos, well, some not necessarily obtained there, but sexual blackmail photos and evidence obtained by some of these organized crime people, again, like Mayor Lansky, he would share some of these pictures with people like James Jesus Angleton, who is one of the top officials of the early CIA. He was head of counterintelligence for years and years and years. So again, you see organized crime is sharing quote unquote intelligence with our intelligence agencies, but it's being used to essentially corrupt our institutions. I mean, Hoover was the head of the top law enforcement agency in the US, and his blackmail by the mob is the most likely example why he never went after organized crime. And that's a provable policy decision on Hoover's part. And I think at this point, it's a matter of record, Hoover's sex life. And of course, during that period of history, being an open homosexual and having that type of power in the US government was just out of the question, right? So he would not have been a difficult figure to blackmail.
I don't have as long of a podcast as people you've talked to have. I actually tuned in to listen to one of your other interviews from back in August, and I don't have quite that luxury. So it's conceivable I may somehow recruit you to come back so we can talk in more detail. But I want to go forward into the Epstein matter itself. And in particular, if we could talk about something that you place a great deal of emphasis on, and that's in the Clinton years. Between 1993 and 1995, there were apparently 17 Epstein visits to the White House that we know of?
Yeah, that we know of. It could be more. I mean, people have found, for example, in looking at White House visitor logs during the Clinton era, that there was a person who signed in, I think, 9 to 10 times. He wrote his name down as Donald Duck. Right? So who was that? It seemed like some people, at least, were using pseudonyms, at least some part of the time, to enter White House grounds while Clinton was in office. And maybe that's also happened for other presidents. I don't know, but it's worth noting that it could well have been more than 17. Of the 17 visits that are recorded, several of those, Epstein is bringing a young woman with him, not underage, of age, but still a young, attractive woman with him in tow on several of these visits. Most of the visits are with a man named Mark Middleton, but his first visit was with Robert Rubin, who was previously head of Goldman Sachs, and then later, of course, became Secretary of Treasury under Clinton. But it's worth pointing out that while he was head of Goldman Sachs was sort of left holding the bag in some sense and was accused of being directly involved in Robert Maxwell's financial crimes as it related to theft of pension funds, among other things, when his businesses collapsed upon his death in 1991. So that's quite an important connection to point out in considering why someone like Robert Rubin would invite Jeffrey Epstein to the White House. But again, the vast majority of these meetings took place between 1994 and January 1995, which is really just about a year. And almost all of those meetings were with a man named Mark Middleton. When the nature of the extent of these meetings was released by the UK's Daily Mail last December, it was not covered by US media at all, including the photograph of Jeffrey Epstein shaking hands with Bill Clinton in 1993. No coverage of that. And then about 5 months later, Mark Middleton is found dead, hanging by the neck by an extension cord and with a shotgun wound to the chest. It is ruled a suicide, and a local Arkansas court rules that no video or multimedia pictures of the scene can be publicly released. The more you look into Mark Middleton, the more insane it becomes, because it turns out that Mark Middleton was a central figure in what today is remembered as the 1996 campaign finance scandal, or in some conservative circles is referred to as quote unquote Chinagate, which is really just an insane example of the drastic undermining of US national security on a massive scale. And Mark Middleton, when he was called to Congress to testify in connection with this scandal, pled the fifth 28 times, including to the question, are you a foreign agent? And he chose not to respond to that, which is pretty telling, I think. And
that should be an easy question to answer, you would think.
Yeah, it's a
for
yes
most
or
people.
No question.
Right, right. Right. Most people.
Right. So at the same time he's meeting with Mark Middleton, Jeffrey Epstein is involved in something very curious on behalf of his benefactor, Leslie Wexner. And actually, allegedly, some of his meetings with Middleton were involved on lobbying Middleton, or rather the White House, about business policies that would benefit Wexner. But going back to what he was doing with Wexner on the other side of things in the same period of time, some people in your audience may be familiar with an airline called Southern Air Transport, because this was a CIA-linked airline that was involved in a lot of illegal activities, including drug running and arms running during the Iran-Contra scandal. Jeffrey Epstein, as I note in the book, has ties to the same people that were responsible for Iran-Contra and was allegedly involved in aspects of Iran-Contra himself. So you have him and Leslie Wexner basically have Southern Air Transport relocate from Miami, where it was doing these flights that in the 80s that were between the U.S. and Latin America that involved the illegal activities I just mentioned. They relocate to Columbus, Ohio, and start going from Columbus, Ohio to Hong Kong, which of course is a city that has a lot of ties to this particular quote unquote Chinagate scandal. So as you can see, this is already sounding quite crazy, especially when you consider that if you look at the attempts by Epstein and Wexner to get an airline to relocate to Columbus, they tried three different airlines. The first of those was Aero Air. Aero Air was also tied to Iran-Contra, arms trafficking, drug trafficking, and also trafficking apparently large amounts of money on behalf of BCCI. After that, they go with something called Polar Air Cargo, which is a joint venture between three companies, one of which is Southern Air Transport. Southern Air Transport and the other two partners of Polar Air Cargo part ways. And then for some reason, Epstein and Wexner want nothing to do with them and then go into business directly with Southern Air Transport. So it becomes pretty clear that they're looking, it seems to me at least, for an airline that is intelligence linked. And it was even known at the time in Ohio, this connections of Southern Air Transport to Iran-Contra and to the CIA. And it came up in local reports, and officials were questioned and were like, oh, well, they promise us that they're not connected to the CIA now. But how believable is that, really, when you have someone like Jeffrey Epstein, who's intelligence connected, having this be relocated? And apparently Epstein seems to have also been rather central to what was going on in quote unquote Chinagate, which among other things, you know, it's remembered, as I mentioned earlier, as the campaign finance scandal, and that was one side of it. But essentially, these irregular finance contributions totaling millions and millions of dollars were being used to change Commerce Department policy so that high-tech, sensitive military technology developed in the U.S. could be sent to front companies owned by the Chinese military. And one of the key people involved in those activities is a businessman named Bernard Schwartz, and he was one of the top donors, actually, I think one of the top two donors to Joe Biden during the 2020 primary in the Democratic Party. So, you know, these people are still around, which is why I would consider people to go back and revisit this particular history, because it's quite stunning to me that so few people knew about it. And I myself, before writing the book, wasn't familiar about it. I was like, who is Mark Middleton? And then I started, you know, he's in all these Senate reports and congressional reports that are largely forgotten today. But it's just very disturbing when you consider that this particular network, even before Chinagate, you have them involved in things like the Promise Software scandal, which again was having our nuclear secrets stolen by foreign entities and then sold essentially all over the world. And nothing was done. There was never any accountability. One of the key people involved in that was Robert Maxwell himself. And his criminal espionage activity against the United States was facilitated by people like Henry Kissinger, who were lauded as wonderful statesmen by the establishment in the U.S. today. So basically, our national security interests have been sold out by the very same people who use the national security justification to cover up for their crimes over and over again, or to justify not releasing information they need to release to the public, among other things. And at the same time, when you consider that a lot of this particular faction or network justified a lot of its activities, for example, Iran-Contra, as necessary to fight communism, for example, they're going and they're teaming up with or passing sensitive military technology to the adversary states of the U.S., like Russia and China. I mean, so ultimately, when you're looking at these types of situations, it becomes very clear that these people have no national allegiance at all. Their allegiance is to expanding their own money and their own power, and the American people be damned. And that is essentially why things are getting as bad as they are. We have a power structure in the U.S. that is hollowing out our country, and they're doing it to benefit themselves. And for the past several decades, they've intentionally been building up the countries that are due to receive the baton from the U.S., moving from this unipolar model to the quote-unquote multipolar model, where Russia and China will be having the top seats at the table. But it's the same group that has essentially engineered that. That's why it's no surprise when you see, like, the World Economic Forum, for instance, promote multipolarity in the multipolar world order. And you have people like Klaus Schwab say China is the model. These same capital networks have brought this upon us.
Hey, folks, quick message from Ole Woods here. If you are looking to add Bitcoin to your retirement account and thinking about the long haul, then the best and easiest way to do that is with BitTrust IRA. BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. It stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. I've often said that if Bitcoin is ever to gain more widespread acceptance, it's going to have to be more user-friendly, and BitTrust IRA could not be easier to use. So go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners, a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. So let me just ask the dumb guy question that I think a lot of people want to know. It's a two-parter. So number one, so-called Epstein's Island, does this thing exist entirely for the purpose of blackmailing and entrapping people, number one? Number two, does the number of visits he makes to the Clinton White House indicate that Bill Clinton himself doesn't really know who Jeffrey Epstein is, that he's not aware of his intelligence ties, or what do the meetings mean?
Okay, so the Clinton thing I'm going to answer later. First of all, I'll talk about the island. So I think the reason Jeffrey Epstein acquired that island, obviously, part of it is related to the sex trafficking, sex blackmail side of his activities. But in addition to that, you have to remember that Jeffrey Epstein, in my opinion, first and foremost, is a financial criminal. So a lot can be said about the banking networks in the Caribbean in terms of facilitating those types of shadow banking activities. With the FTX scandal, for instance, right now, you know, you have the Bahamas being scrutinized for its role there. But, you know, Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, the Virgin Islands, more often than not, have ties to this sort of offshore financial system where these financial crimes in which Epstein and, of course, other people have participated take place. And also, Jeffrey Epstein had other businesses registered in the Virgin Islands. He was interested in educating certain youths in the Virgin Islands for various purposes, and he wanted to also obtain the genetic data of large swaths of the native islander population to develop what he referred to as a biomedical Google, where he wanted to have people's genotypes be searched and that would they'd be able to determine if they had any sort of disease before the onset of disease, sort of an early venture into the same space of medicine we're seeing being sort of foisted upon the public today, which is more or less a merger of Silicon Valley interests and big pharma interests coming together to promote things like mRNA vaccines, CRISPR, nanotechnology and medicine, among other things. And if you look at Epstein's science ties, it's pretty clear that he was very involved in those networks, at least before he became, according to his own description, quote unquote, radioactive because of his conviction in the early-ish 2000s for sex trafficking. So to answer the other question about Clinton, so I don't think it's fair to say that Bill Clinton didn't know who Jeffrey Epstein was or his intelligence connections. But it seems like to me, Jeffrey Epstein was sort of a financial wizard for the Clintons. I say this because Jeffrey Epstein between 1987 and 1993 was involved in masterminding one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in U.S. history, Towers Financial. During the grand jury hearings into investigating Towers Financial, Jeffrey Epstein is named as the mastermind, but his name a few months later is dropped from the case. Overlapping with that, convenient development for him of his name being dropped for the case. He is involved in fundraisers at the White House and has already met with Robert Rubin and is involved in a White House Historical Association fundraiser that involves people that were involved in the BCCI scandal, like Clark Clifford, among others. That particular fundraiser makes an odd appearance in Vince Foster's quote-unquote suicide note. Moving ahead, we have what I mentioned earlier, Epstein's apparent involvement through Middleton in the campaign finance scandal of 1996. And then, of course, after Clinton leaves office, we have Jeffrey Epstein being intimately involved in the creation of what is today the Clinton Foundation, and also the Clinton Health Access Initiative, which is related to these Clinton family, quote unquote, philanthropies, as we know today. The Clinton Foundation is basically a slush fund for the Clintons. You have a person who was a provable financial criminal who, in a normal world, would have been prosecuted for those crimes, but instead he goes to the heights of power at the White House and becomes involved in two of the most suspect fundraisers of the entire Clinton presidency, and then becomes involved in creating and developing the post-presidency slush fund of the Clinton family. That's very significant. And so that's why I think it's very telling that mainstream media, when they talk about the Epstein-Clinton relationship, only start at 2000. Because if you cut off all the Clinton White House connections, you don't really see the big picture and you don't see this trajectory that I've just explained that shows, among other things, the Clintons' propensity to engage in financial shenanigans.
I want to ask you about one other name that has obviously, let's say, to put it mildly, been in the news, namely Bill Gates. Now, we know that earlier this year, his now ex-wife, I guess, gave an interview with CBS in which, as you know, she said that among other things that she could point to in the marriage, she was concerned about his deep connections to the, quote, abhorrent Jeffrey Epstein. Do you think that's just an after-the-fact rationalization? Do you think that's a genuine concern on her part? And do we know anything at all about the nature of that relationship?
Yeah, so there's been a major cover-up of the nature of that relationship. So if you believe mainstream media or Melinda Gates, Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Gates did not meet until 2011. If that is true, then why does the Evening Standard, a mainstream media outlet in the United Kingdom, report in 2001 that Jeffrey Epstein made his money through his business links to three men, Leslie Wexner, Donald Trump, and Bill Gates? Once you start investigating those connections, it starts to become quite clear that the 2011 date is a lie, mainly because at that point in time, Bill Gates was no longer running Microsoft. If you look at Jeffrey Epstein's ties, not just to Bill Gates, but to Microsoft, it becomes very apparent that Jeffrey Epstein, at least from 1995 on, was very involved with the top executives at Microsoft, involved in activities with them that still requires some unraveling, but we can get little peaks of what was really going on there. And I did my best to try and piece that together in the book, because it doesn't just involve Epstein and his relationship with Microsoft's chief technical officer, Nathan Myhrvold, or their other top executives like Linda Stone, among others, in this same period before the year 2001. But you also have the Maxwells, including Isabel Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's sister, having a documented business relationship with Bill Gates and Microsoft well before the year 2000. And that particular company where Isabel Maxwell forged ties initially with Microsoft and Bill Gates, Ghislaine Maxwell had a major stake in that company, a major financial stake in the company. And it's very possible that Jeffrey Epstein, because of his close relationship with Ghislaine Maxwell at that time, may have had some connection himself to that particular business entity. You then have the case of a woman named Melanie Walker, who Jeffrey Epstein met when she was attempting to become a Victoria's Secret model in 1992. There's no evidence that Melanie ever modeled for Victoria's Secret, but she did at some point, just a few years later, I believe 1996 or so, maybe 1998, can't quite remember the date. But in the late 90s, she became Jeffrey Epstein's science advisor. A few years later, she has a relatively uneventful stint with the World Health Organization, and then after that is hired as a science advisor to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in, I think, 2003 or so. So at this point, her resume is this brief stint with the WHO in China, I believe. And then before that is Jeffrey Epstein's science advisor. So if you're going to be appointed to be the top science advisor to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I think it's safe to say that both Bill and Melinda are involved in deciding whether or not to hire you. And if your resume says science advisor to Jeffrey Epstein and you're applying to be science advisor to Bill Gates, it would make sense that Bill Gates would know who Jeffrey Epstein is and what kind of science he was interested in. And it was through Melanie Walker that Jeffrey Epstein was introduced to another science advisor at the Gates Foundation, Boris Nikolic. And when Jeffrey Epstein died in 2019, it turns out that he had named as one of the executors of his estate as Boris Nikolic. So there's obviously a lot going on here that the mainstream media is very unwilling to talk about. And there are numerous pieces that we can pick apart. I've really only just brought up a few of them, to be honest. There's, of course, more in the book that really dismantles this mainstream media claim that they met in 2011 and not before. But the fact that they won't go that far and even bother to look at all this stuff that I've just mentioned is very telling that, in my opinion, it's more not just about protecting Gates, it's about protecting Microsoft. Because you have an intelligence agent tied to a foreign intelligence agency at this point in time, Israel, being involved in arguably one of the top tech companies in the world. I mean, it was actually a monopoly, according to the US government in the late 90s, having relationships with a spy, right? And you also have Epstein, for example, being involved with trips of top Microsoft executives to Russia. And apparently Microsoft has some sort of weird connection to some of this ChinaGate stuff I mentioned earlier. And you also have the weird situation of Isabel Maxwell's company that was tied to Israeli intelligence, unable to conduct its IPL because of a faltering stock price. And then even though they had never turned a profit in their short existence as a company and were drowning in debt, both Microsoft co-founders, Bill Gates and Paul Allen, infused that company with a significant amount of money that, if you look at the return on investment, was an awful investment for them. This is after Isabel Maxwell already has this relationship with Bill Gates that goes back to 1995 or so. So again, there's a lot of intrigue here. There's a lot of information. And unfortunately, because of the lack of transparency from the government and mainstream media, we're left to basically follow a trail of breadcrumbs to try and find out what was really going on. And that's what I've tried to do. But we may not know exactly all the details, but we know enough to know that there is a cover-up.
Right, right, right. Let me read just one sentence from your book to maybe ask you to elaborate on it before we wrap up. I'd like to know what this development means, in your opinion, for Americans and for the future of the U.S. You were saying more or less that a figure like Jeffrey Epstein is no longer as central to any kind of blackmail regime because, as you put it, now, technology-derived blackmail is harvested through systems of mass surveillance. So what does that look like and what does that mean for Americans and what can be done about it?
Yeah, so in explaining how I got to that point, I talk a lot about companies like Palantir and how that's really a successor to the Promise Software scandal and how business partners of the Maxwell sisters were involved in creating Palantir's product, for example. If you're not familiar with Palantir, it's basically a data mining program that is used to basically turn the masses of data that are gobbled up by the NSA and related entities on what you do online. They turn those masses of data into actionable intelligence. They also use it to profile people. And Palantir is the resurrected version of a program that was planned by Iran-Contra conspirator John Poindexter, considered the godfather of modern surveillance. That program was going to be run by DARPA. It was called Total Information Awareness. People rightly pointed out at the time, including in mainstream media, that that would have completely eliminated any notion of privacy in the United States for civilian, non-civilian, really anyone living within the United States. And so it was defunded by Congress, but it was resurrected by Peter Thiel and InQtel to become Palantir. So when Peter Thiel talks about being a libertarian, it's quite amazing that he created a company that is arguably the most Orwellian and horrible of all and gave the national security state a tool that is probably going to be more prominent in enslaving the American population than anything else. But anyway, returning to Palantir, their only client for the first 3 years of their existence was the CIA, and the CIA developed their software. When they profile people, they can label a person as a subversive. And this particular network that I'm talking about here developed something in the 1980s as part of the Iran-Contra whatever. They developed a dissident database called Main Core of Americans who were deemed unfriendly, quote unquote, and could be rounded up in the event of a vaguely defined national emergency. Main Core has never gone away. People at the White House after 9/11 saw it being used on White House computers. And basically everything the NSA has ever sucked up on you is in your main core profile if you are one of the unlucky Americans to be on it. And as of 2008, which was the last time anyone in mainstream or mainstream adjacent media reported on main core, it had, I believe, either 6 or 8 million Americans on it. So at this point, it's probably safe to say that it's a bit more. And Palantir is the software that's used to profile you, essentially. So we have a very serious issue in this country with the failure to follow up on obvious crimes that have been committed by the surveillance state against American civil liberties. So in terms of electronic blackmail, where this comes in, you are being watched, right? So everything you do online, you search the wrong thing, you search the wrong term. Someone in your household, for example, searches for Pornhub or something like that. The national security state can know that. If you're a person and they want to control you, they don't need to set you up with an underage minor or have someone like Jeffrey Epstein or Ghislaine Maxwell around. They can just look at your Google search history or some of this other data that they are sucking up that you are producing and find something in it to blackmail you with. Our secrets are online these days more than they are offline for a lot of people. And so they don't have to spend the time investing in someone like Jeffrey Epstein. If you think about what goes into a sexual blackmail operation, you have to pay the people that are running it. You have to help maintain the place, probably a mansion or some fancy place, right? You have to maintain that or pay the rent for it or buy the property. You have to pay off local law enforcement to not go nosing around down there if they get tipped off, among other things. It's expensive and it can also be risky if the operation is exposed. In the digital sense, the payoff is the same, but the investment is negligible.
Well, look, the book is One Nation Under Blackmail, The Sordid Union Between Intelligence and Organized Crime That Gave Rise to Jeffrey Epstein. This is a chapter of American history that you're just not going to see in a textbook, just not ever for some reason. You just won't get it. You'll get pictures of U.S. flags waving in the breeze. You'll get whatever, but you will not get this. And in order to get it, we need to step outside of the traditional sources we consult for the news. So we're not going to get it from the major newspapers. We're not going to get it on television. But we do get it from people like Whitney Webb, who actually give meaning to the word journalist, who actually, you know, who make the word journalist not a joke anymore. And this project, I can't imagine how much work was involved, but just a staggering amount. And it's such an important service for us. And of course, you have to make a living, but in so doing, you're also doing a very important service for the American public that has been completely in the dark about all this. So I've got this linked on our show notes page for today. This is episode 2247. So it's at tomwoods.com/2247. I'll give you the final word, Whitney.
Sure. So yes, this project was a lot of work, but I could not have done it alone. I had a really amazing research assistant named Ed Berger that helped extensively with key parts of the book. So I definitely want to make sure that he is recognized. And I built off the work of some other great people who, of course, are cited in the book or on the acknowledgements page. And ultimately, what I hope from people that read the book is not only to sort of question what we do next and how do we deal with this situation when the government is too corrupt to even investigate itself about these matters, but I would also really hope that people that are interested, there's much more work to be done on these subjects. Some of these chapters in and of themselves could have been expanded to be entire books, right? So ultimately, I would hope that someone out there, whether you have no platform or a big platform, maybe you could help see if there's anything else to dig up in these histories that are more or less hidden from the American public, because there's obviously a lot more work to be done there. I don't claim to be telling you literally everything that's been hidden from you either, but you know, I'm trying to start somewhere. And the more people that collaborate on these types of subjects, the better is how I look at it.
Well, absolutely. So again, check out tomwoods.com/2247. That's where you can easily pick up these volumes. And Whitney, thanks so much once again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.